Chapter 18 of My Mark Twain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. My Mark Twain by William Dean Howells. Chapter 18. The occasions which brought us to New York together were not nearly so frequent as those which united us in Boston, but there was a dinner party given him by a friend which remains memorable from the fatuity of two men present, so different in everything but their fatuity. One was the sweet old comedian Billy Florence, who was urging the unsuccessful dramatist across the table to write him a play about Oliver Cromwell, and giving the reasons why he thought himself peculiarly fitted to portray the character of Cromwell. The other was a modestly millioned rich man, who was then only beginning to amass the monies afterward heaped so high, and was still in the condition to be flattered by the condescension of a yet greater millionaire. His contribution to our gaiety was the verbatim report of a call he had made upon William H. Vanderbilt, whom he had found just about starting out of town, with his trunks actually in the front hall, but who had stayed to receive the narrator. He had, in fact, sat down on one of the trunks and talked with the easiest friendliness and quite, we were given to infer, like an ordinary human being. Clemens often kept on with some thread of the talk when he came away from a dinner, but now he was silent, as if high, sorrowful, and cloyed, and it was not till afterward that I found he had noted the facts, from the bitterness with which he mocked the rich man, and the pity he expressed for the actor. He had begun before that to amass those evidences against mankind which eventuated with him in his theory of what he called the damned human race. This was not an expression of piety, but of the kind contempt to which he was driven by our follies and iniquities, as he had observed them in himself, as well as in others. It was as mild a misanthropy, probably, as ever caressed the objects of its malediction. But I believe it was about the year 1900 that his sense of our perdition became insupportable, and broke out in a mixed abhorrence and amusement which spared no occasion, so that I could quite understand why Mrs. Clemens should have found some compensation, when kept to her room by her sickness, in the reflection that now she should not have to hear so much about the damned human race. He told of that with the same wild joy that he told of overhearing her repetition of one of his most inclusive profanities, and her explanation that she meant him to hear it, so that he might know how it sounded. The contrast of the lurid blasphemy with which her heavenly whiteness should have been enough to cure anyone less grounded than he in what must be owned was as fixed a habit as smoking with him. When I first knew him, he rarely vented his fury in that sort, and I fancy he was under a promise to her which he kept sacred till the wear and tear of his nerves with advancing years disabled him. Then it would be like him to struggle with himself till he could struggle no longer, and to ask his promise back, and it would be like her to give it back. His profanity was the heritage of his boyhood and young manhood in social conditions, and under the duress of exigencies in which everybody swore, about as impersonally as he smoked. It is best to recognize the fact of it, and I do so more readily, because I cannot suppose the recording angel really minded it much more than that guardian angel of his. It probably grieved them about equally, but they could equally forgive it. Nothing came of his pose regarding the damned human race, except his invention of the Human Race Luncheon Club. This was confined to four persons, who were never all got together, and it soon perished of their indifference. In the earlier days that I have more specially in mind, one of the questions that we used to debate a good deal was whether every human motive was not selfish. We inquired as to every impulse, the noblest, the holiest, in effect, and he found them in the last analysis of selfish origin. Pretty nearly the whole time of a certain railroad run from New York to Hartford was taken up with the scrutiny of the self-sacrifice of a mother for her child, of the abandon of the lover who dies in saving his mistress from fire or flood, of the hero's courage in the field, and the martyr's at the stake. Each he found springing from the unconscious love of self, and the dread of the greater pain which the self-sacrificer would suffer in forbearing the sacrifice. If we had any time left from this inquiry that day, he must have devoted it to a high regret that Napoleon did not carry out his purpose of invading England, for then he would have destroyed the feudal aristocracy, or reformed the lords, as it might be called now. He thought that would have been an incalculable blessing to the English people and the world. Clemens was always beautifully and unfalteringly a Republican. None of his occasional misgivings for America implicated a return to monarchy. Yet he felt passionately the splendor of the English monarchy, and there was a time when he gloried in that figurative poetry by which the king was phrased as the majesty of England. He rolled the words deep-throatedly out, and exulted in their beauty as if it were beyond any other glory of the world. He read, or read at, English history a great deal, and one of the byproducts of his restless invention was a game of English kings, like the game of authors, for children. I do not know whether he ever perfected this, but I am quite sure it was not put upon the market. Very likely he brought it to a practicable stage and then tired of it, as he was apt to do in the ultimation of his vehement undertakings. End of chapter 18. Read by Dennis Sayers in Modesto, California for LibriVox. Winter 2007. Chapter 19 of My Mark Twain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. My Mark Twain by William Dean Howells. Chapter 19. He satisfied the impassioned demand of his nature for incessant activities of every kind by taking a personal as well as a pecuniary interest in the inventions of others. At one moment, the damned human race was almost to be redeemed by a process of founding brass without air bubbles in it. If this could once be accomplished, as I understood, or misunderstood, brass could be used in art printing to a degree hitherto impossible. I dare say I have got it wrong, but I am not mistaken as to Clemens' enthusiasm for the process, and his heavy losses in paying its way to ultimate. He was simultaneously absorbed in the perfection of a typesetting machine, which he was paying the inventor a salary to bring to a perfection so expensive that it was practically impracticable. We were both printers by trade, and I could take the same interest in this wonderful piece of mechanism that he could. And it was so truly wonderful that it did everything but walk and talk. Its ingenious creator was so bent upon realizing the highest ideal in it that he produced a machine of quite unimpeachable efficiency. But it was so costly when finished that it could not be made for less than $20,000 if the parts were made by hand. This sum was prohibitive of its introduction, unless the requisite capital could be found for making the parts by machinery, and Clemens spent many months in vainly trying to get this money together. In the meantime, simpler machines had been invented and the market filled, and his investment of $300,000 in the beautiful miracle remained permanent, but not profitable. I once went with him to witness its performance, and it did seem to me the last word in its way, but it had been spoken too exquisitely, too fastidiously. I never heard him devote the inventor to the infernal gods, as he was apt to with the geniuses he lost money by, and so I think he did not regard him as a traitor. In these things, and in his other schemes for the subiti guadagni of the speculator, and the sudden making of splendid names for the benefactors of our species, Clemens satisfied the Colonel Sellers nature in himself, from which he drew the picture of that wild and lovable creature, and perhaps made as good use of his money as he could. He did not much care for money in itself, but he luxuriated in the lavish use of it, and he was as generous with it as ever a man was. He liked giving it, but he commonly wearied of giving it himself, and wherever he lived, he established an almoner, whom he fully trusted to keep his left hand ignorant of what his right hand was doing. I believe he felt no finality in charity, but did it because, in its provisional way, it was the only thing a man could do. I never heard him go really into any sociological inquiry, and I have a feeling that that sort of thing baffled and dispirited him. No one can read the Connecticut Yankee and not be aware of the length and breadth of his sympathies with poverty. But, apparently, he had not thought out any scheme for the economic wrongs we abound in. I cannot remember our ever getting quite down to a discussion of the matter. We came very near it once, in the day of the vast wave of emotion sent over the world by looking backward, and, again, when we were all so troubled by the great coal strike in Pennsylvania. In considering that he seemed to be, for the time, doubtful of the justice of the working man's cause. At all other times he seemed to know that whatever wrongs the working man committed, work was always in the right. When Clemens returned to America with his family after lecturing around the world, I again saw him in New York, where I so often saw him, while he was shaping himself for that heroic enterprise. He would come to me and talk sorrowfully over his financial ruin, and picture it to himself as the stuff of some unhappy dream, which, after long prosperity, had culminated the wrong way. It was very melancholy, very touching, but the sorrow to which he had come home from his long journey had not that forlorn bewilderment in it. He was looking wonderfully well, and when I asked for him the name of his elixir, he said it was plasmon. He was apt for a man who had put faith so decidedly away from him to take it back and pin it to some superstition, usually of a hygienic sort. Once, when he was well on in years, he came to New York without glasses, and announced that he and all his family, so astigmatic and myopic and old-sighted, had, so to speak, burned their spectacles behind them, upon the instruction of some sage who had found out that they were a delusion. The next time he came he wore spectacles freely, almost ostentatiously, and I heard from others that the whole Clemens family had been near losing their eyesight by the miracle worked in their behalf. Now I was not surprised to learn that the damned human race was to be saved by plasmon, if anything, and that my first duty was to visit the plasmon agency with him and procure enough plasmon to secure my family against the ills it was heir to forevermore. I did not immediately understand that plasmon was one of the investments which he had made from the substance of things hoped for and in the destiny of a disastrous disappointment. But after paying off all the creditors of his late publishing firm, he had to do something with his money, and it was not his fault if he did not make a fortune out of plasmon. End of chapter 19, read by Dennis Sayers in Modesto, California for LibriVox, Winter 2007. Chapter 20 of My Mark Twain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. My Mark Twain by William Dean Howells. Chapter 20. For a time it was a question whether he should not go back with his family to their old home in Hartford. Perhaps the father's and mother's hearts drew them there all the more strongly because of the grief written ineffaceably over it, but for the younger ones it was no longer the measure of the world. It was easier for all to stay on indefinitely in New York, which is a sojourn without circumstance, and equally the home of exile and of indecision. The Clemenses took a pleasant, spacious house at Riverdale on the Hudson, and there I began to see them again on something like the sweet old terms. They lived far more unpretentiously than they used, and I think with a notion of economy, which they had never very successfully practiced. I recall that at the end of a certain year in Hartford, when they had been saving and paying cash for everything, Clemens wrote, reminding me of their avowed experiment, and asking me to guess how many bills they had at New Year's. He hastened to say that a horse car would not have held them. At Riverdale, they kept no carriage, and there was a snowy night when I drove up to their handsome old mansion in the station carryall, which was crusted with mud as from going down to the deluge after transporting Noah and his family from the Ark to whatever point they decided to settle at provisionally. But the good talk, the rich talk, the talk that could never suffer poverty of mind or soul, was there, and we jubilantly found ourselves again in our middle youth. It was the mighty moment when Clemens was building his engines of war for the destruction of Christian Science, which superstition nobody, and he least of all, expected to destroy. It would not be easy to say whether in his talk of it his disgust for the illiterate twaddle of Mrs. Eddy's book or his admiration of her genius for organization was the greater. He believed that as a religious machine the Christian Science Church was as perfect as the Roman Church, and destined to be more formidable in its control of the minds of men. He looked for it spread over the whole of Christendom, and throughout the winter he spent at Riversdale he was ready to meet all listeners more than halfway with his convictions of its powerful grasp of the average human desire to get something for nothing. The vacuous vulgarity of its texts was a perpetual joy to him, which he bowed with serious respect to the sagacity which built so securely upon the everlasting rock of human credulity and folly. An interesting phase of his psychology in this business was not only his admiration for the masterly policy of the Christian Science hierarchy, but his willingness to allow the miracles of its healers to be tried on his friends and family, if they wished it. He had a tender heart for the whole generation of empirics, as well as the newer sorts of scienticians, but he seemed to base his faith in them largely upon the failure of the regulars, rather than upon their own successes, which, also, he believed in. He was recurrently, but not insistently, desirous that you should try their strange magics when you were going to try the familiar medicines. End of chapter 20. Read by Dennis Sayers in Modesto, California for LibriVox, Winter 2007. Chapter 21 From My Mark Twain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. My Mark Twain by William Dean Howells. Chapter 21. The order of my acquaintance, or call it intimacy, with Clemens was this: our first meeting in Boston, my visits to him in Hartford, his visits to me in Cambridge, in Belmont, and in Boston, our briefer and less frequent meetings in Paris and New York, all with repeated interruptions through my absences in Europe and his sojourns in London, Berlin, Vienna, and Florence, and his flights to the many ends and odds and ends of the earth. I will not try to follow the events, if they were not rather the subjective experiences of those different periods and points of time, which I must not fail to make include his summer at York Harbor, and his divers residences in New York, on 10th Street and on 5th Avenue, at Riverdale and at Stormfield, which his daughter has told me he loved best of all his houses and hoped to make his home for long years. Not much remains to me of the week or so that we had together in Paris early in the summer of 1904. The first thing I got at my banker's was a cable message announcing that my father was stricken with paralysis, but urging my stay for further intelligence, and I went about, till the final summons came, with my head in a mist of care and dread. Clemens was very kind and brotherly through it all. He was living greatly, to his mind, in one of those arcaded little hotels in the Rue de Rivoli, and he was free from all household duties to range with me. We drove together to make calls of digestion at many houses, where he had got indigestion through his reluctance from their hospitality, for he hated dining out. But, as he explained, his wife wanted him to make these visits, and he did it, as he did everything she wanted. At one place, some suburban villa, He could get no answer to his ring, and he hove his cards over the gate just as it opened, and he had the shame of explaining in his unexplanatory French to the man picking them up. He was excruciatingly helpless with his cabmen, but by very cordially smiling and casting himself on the driver's mercy, he always managed to get where he wanted. The family was on the verge of their many moves, and he was doing some small errands. He said that the others did the main things, and left him to do what the cat might. It was with that return upon the buoyant billow of plasmon, renewed in look and limb, that Clemens's universally pervasive popularity began in his own country. He had hitherto been more intelligently accepted or more largely imagined in Europe, and I suppose it was my sense of this that inspired the stupidity of my saying to him, when we came to consider the state of polite learning among us, "You mustn't expect people to keep it up here as they do in England." But it appeared that his countrymen were only wanting the chance, and they kept it up in honor of him past all precedent. One does not go into a catalogue of dinners, receptions, meetings, speeches, and the like, when there are more vital things to speak of. He loved these obvious joys, and he eagerly strove with the occasions they gave him for the brilliancy which seemed so exhaustless and was so exhausting. His friend saw that he was wearing himself out, and it was not because of Mrs. Clemens's health alone that they were glad to have him take refuge at Riverdale. The family lived there 2 happy, hopeless years, and then it was ordered that they should change, for his wife's sake, to some less exacting climate. Clemens was not eager to go to Florence, but his imagination was taken, as it would have been in the old young days, by the notion of packing his furniture into flexible steel cages from his house in Hartford, and unpacking it from them untouched at his villa in Fiesole. He got what pleasure any man could out of that triumph of mind over matter, but the shadow was creeping up his life. One sunny afternoon, we sat on the grass before the mansion, after his wife had begun to get well enough for removal, and we looked up toward a balcony, where, by and by, that lovely presence made itself visible, as if it had stooped there from a cloud. A hand frailly waved a handkerchief. Clemens ran over the lawn toward it, calling tenderly, "What? What?" as if it might be an asking for him instead of the greeting it really was for me. It was the last time I saw her, if indeed I can be said to have seen her then, and long afterward, when I said how beautiful we all thought her, how good, how wise, how wonderfully perfect in every relation of life, he cried out in a breaking voice, "Oh, why didn't you ever tell her? She thought you didn't like her." What a pang it was then not to have told her. But how could we have told her? His unreason endeared him to me more than all his wisdom. To that Riverdale sojourn belong my impressions of his most violent anti-Christian Science rages, which began with the postponement of his book, and softened into acceptance of the delay till he had well nigh forgotten his wrath when it came out. There was also one of those joint episodes of ours which, strangely enough, did not eventuate in entire failure, as most of our joint episodes did. He wrote furiously to me of a wrong which had been done to him, of the most helpless and one of the most helped of our literary brethren, asking me to join with him in recovering the money paid over by that brother's publisher to a false friend, who had withheld it and would not give any account of it. Our hapless brother had appealed to Clemens, as he had to me, with the facts, but not asking our help, probably because he knew he need not ask, and Clemens enclosed to me a very taking-by-the-throat message which he proposed sending to the false friend. For once I had some sense, and answered that this would never do, for we had really no power in the matter, and I contrived a letter to the recreant so softly diplomatic that I shall always think of it with pride when my honesties no longer give me satisfaction, saying that this incident had come to our knowledge, and suggesting that we felt sure he would not finally wish to withhold the money. Nothing more, practically, than that. But that was enough. There came promptly back a letter of justification, covering a very substantial check, which we, hilariously, forwarded to our beneficiary. But the helpless man, who was so used to being helped, did not answer with the gladness I, at least, expected of him. He acknowledged the check as he would any ordinary payment, and then he made us observe that there was still a large sum due him out of the monies withheld. At this point, I proposed to Clemens that we should let the nonchalant victim collect the remnant himself. Clouds of sorrow had gathered about the bowed head of the delinquent since we began on him, and my fickle sympathies were turning his way from the victim, who was really to blame for leaving his affairs so unguardedly, to him in the first place. Clemens made some sort of grit assent, and we dropped the matter. He was more used to ingratitude from those he helped than I was, who found being laid down upon not so amusing as he found my revolt. He reckoned I was right, he said, and after that I think we never recurred to the incident. It was not ingratitude that he ever minded. It was treachery that really maddened him past forgiveness. End of chapter 21. Read by Dennis Sayers in Modesto, California, for LibriVox, winter 2007. Chapter 22 of My Mark Twain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. My Mark Twain by William Dean Howells. Chapter 22. During the summer he spent at York Harbor, I was only 40 minutes away at Kittery Point, and we saw each other often. But this was before the last time at Riverdale. He had a wide, low cottage in a pine grove overlooking York River, and we used to sit at a corner of the veranda farthest away from Mrs. Clemens's window, where we could read our manuscripts to each other and tell our stories and laugh our hearts out without disturbing her. At first she had been about the house, and there was one gentle afternoon when she made tea for us in the parlor. But that was the last time I spoke with her. After that, it was really a question of how soonest and easiest she could be got back to Riverdale. But, of course, there were specious delays in which she seemed no worse and seemed a little better, and Clemens could work at a novel he had begun. He had taken a room in the house of a friend and neighbor, a fisherman and boatman, There was a table where he could write, and a bed where he could lie down and read, and there, unless my memory has played me one of those constructive tricks that people's memories indulge in, he read me the first chapters of an admirable story. The scene was laid in a Missouri town, and the characters such as he had known in boyhood. But as often as I tried to make him own it, he denied having written any such story. It is possible that I dreamed it, but I hope the manuscript will yet be found. Upon reflection, I cannot believe that I dreamed it, and I cannot believe that it was an effect of that sort of pseudo-mnemonics which I have mentioned. The characters in the novel are too clearly outlined in my recollection, together with some critical reservations of my own concerning them. Not only does he seem to have read me those first chapters, but to have talked them over with me and outlined the whole story. I cannot say whether or not he believed that his wife would recover. He fought the fear of her death to the end, for her life was far more largely his than the lives of most men's wives are theirs. For his own life, I believe, he would never have much cared, if I may trust a saying of one who was so absolutely without pose as he was. He said that he never saw a dead man whom he did not envy for having had it over and being done with it. Life had always amused him, and in the resurgence of its interests after his sorrow had ebbed away, he was again deeply interested in the world and in the human race, which, though damned, abounded in subjects of curious inquiry. When the time came for his wife's removal from York Harbor, I went with him to Boston, where he wished to look up the best means of her conveyance to New York. The inquiry absorbed him. The sort of invalid car he could get, how she could be carried to the village station, how the car could be detached from the eastern train at Boston and carried round to the southern train on the other side of the city, and then how it could be attached to the Hudson River train at New York and left at Riverdale. There was no particular of the business which he did not scrutinize and master, not only with his poignant concern for her welfare, but with his strong curiosity as to how these unusual things were done with the usual means. With the inertness that grows upon an aging man, he had been used to delegating more and more things, but of that thing I perceived that he would not delegate the least detail. He had meant never to go abroad again, but when it came time to go, he did not look forward to returning. He expected to live in Florence always after that. They were used to the life, and they had been happy there some years earlier, before he went with his wife for the cure of Nauheim. But when he came home again, it was for good and all. It was natural that he should wish to live in New York, where they had already had a pleasant year in 10th Street. I used to see him there in an upper room, looking south over a quiet open space of backyards, where we fought our battles on behalf of the Filipinos and the Boers, and he carried on his campaign against the missionaries in China. He had not yet formed his habit of lying for whole days in bed and reading and writing there, yet he was a good deal in bed, from weakness, I suppose, and for the mere comfort of it. My perspectives are not very clear, and in the foreshortening of events which always takes place in our review of the past, I may not always time things aright. But I believe it was not until he had taken his house at 21 Fifth Avenue that he began to talk to me of writing his autobiography. He meant that it should be a perfectly veracious record of his life and period. For the first time in literature, there should be a true history of a man and a true presentation of the men the man had known. As we talked it over, the scheme enlarged itself in our riotous fancy. He said it should be not only a book, it should be a library. Not only a library, but a literature. It should make good the world's loss through Omar's barbarity at Alexandria. There was no image so grotesque, so extravagant, that we did not play with it. And the work, so far as he carried it, was really done on a colossal scale. But one day he said that as to veracity, it was a failure. He had begun to lie, and that if no man ever yet told the truth about himself, it was because no man ever could. How far he had carried his autobiography, I cannot say. He dictated the matter several hours each day, and the public has already seen long passages from it, and can judge, probably, of the make and matter of the whole form from these. It is immensely inclusive, and it observes no order or sequence. Whether now, after his death, it will be published soon or late, I have no means of knowing. Once or twice he said, in a vague way, that it was not to be published for 20 years, so that the discomfort of publicity might be minimized for all the survivors. Suddenly he told me he was not working at it, but I did not understand whether he had finished it or merely dropped it. I never asked. We lived in the same city, but for old men, rather far apart, he at 10th Street and I at 70th, and with our colds and other disabilities, we did not see each other often. He expected me to come to him, and I would not without some return of my visits. But we never ceased to be friends, and good friends, so far as I know. I joked him once as to how I was going to come out in his autobiography, and he gave me some sort of joking reassurance. There was one incident, however, that brought us very frequently and actively together. He came one Sunday afternoon to have me call with him on Maxim Gorky, who was staying at a hotel a few streets above mine. We were both interested in Gorky, Clemens rather more as a revolutionist, and I as a realist, though I too wished the Russian Tsar ill, and the novelist well in his mission to the Russian sympathizers in this republic. But I had lived through the episode of Kossuth's visit to us and his vain endeavor to raise funds for the Hungarians' cause in 1851, when we were a younger and nobler nation than now, with hearts, if not hands, opener to the oppressed of Europe, the oppressed of America, the 4 or 5 millions of slaves we did not count. I did not believe Gorky could get the money for the cause of freedom in Russia, which he had come to get. As I told a valued friend of his and mine, I did not believe he could get $2,500, and I think now I set the figure too high. I had already refused to sign the sort of general appeal his friends were making to our principles and pockets, because I felt it so wholly idle. And when the paper was produced in Gorky's presence, and Clemens put his name to it, I still refused. The next day, Gorky was expelled from his hotel with the woman who was not his wife, but who, I am bound to say, did not look as if she were not, at least to me, who am, however, not versed in those aspects of human nature. I might have escaped unnoted, but Clemens' familiar head gave us away to the reporters waiting at the elevator's mouth for all who went to see Gorky. As it was, a hunt of interviewers ensued for us severally and jointly. I could remain aloof in my hotel apartment, returning answer to such guardians of the public right to know everything that I had nothing to say of Gorky's domestic affairs, for the public interest had now strayed far from the revolution and centered entirely upon these. But with Clemens it was different. He lived in a house with a street door kept by a single butler, and he was constantly rung for. I forget how long the siege lasted, but long enough for us to have fun with it. There was the moment of the great Vesuvian eruption, and we figured ourselves in easy reach of a volcano, which was every now and then blowing a cone off, as the telegraphic phrase was. The roof of the great market in Naples had just broken in under its load of ashes and cinders, and crashed hundreds of people. And we asked each other if we were not sorry we had not been there, where the pressure would have been far less terrific than it was with us in Fifth Avenue. The forbidden butler came up with a message that there were some gentlemen below who wanted to see Clemens. "How many?" he demanded. "Five," the butler faltered. "Reporters?" The butler feigned uncertainty. "What would you do?" he asked me. "I wouldn't see them," I said. And then Clemens went directly down to them. How or by what means he appeased their veracity, I cannot say, but I fancy it was by the confession of the exact truth, which was harmless enough. They went away joyfully, and he came back in radiant satisfaction with having seen them. Of course, he was right and I wrong, and he was right as to the point at issue between Gorky and those who had helplessly treated him with such cruel ignominy. In America, it is not the convention for men to live openly in hotels with women who are not their wives. Gorky had violated this convention, and he had to pay the penalty. And concerning the destruction of his efficiency as an emissary of the revolution, his blunder was worse than a crime. End of chapter 22. Read by Dennis Sayers in Modesto, California, for LibriVox. Winter 2007. Chapter 23 of My Mark Twain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. My Mark Twain by William Dean Howells. Chapter 23. To the period of Clemens's residence in Fifth Avenue belongs his efflorescence in white serge. He was always rather aggressively indifferent about dress, and at a very early date in our acquaintance, Aldrich and I attempted his reform by clubbing to buy him a cravat. But he would not put away his stiff little black bow, and until he imagined the suit of white serge, he wore always a suit of black serge, truly deplorable in the cut of the sagging frock. After his measure had once been taken, he refused to make his clothes the occasion of personal interviews with his tailor. He sent the stuff by the kind elderly woman who had been in the service of the family from the earliest days of his marriage, and accepted the result without criticism. But the white serge was an inspiration which few men would have had the courage to act upon. The first time I saw him wear it was at the author's hearing before the Congressional Committee on Copyright in Washington. Nothing could have been more dramatic than the gesture with which he flung off his long, loose overcoat and stood forth in white from his feet to the crown of his silvery head. It was a magnificent coup, and he dearly loved a coup. But the magnificent speech which he made, tearing to shreds the venerable farrago of nonsense about non-property in ideas which had formed the basis of all copyright legislation, made you forget even his spectacularity. It is well known how proud he was of his Oxford gown, not merely because it symbolized the honor in which he was held by the highest literary body in the world, but because it was so rich and so beautiful. The red and the lavender of the cloth flattered his eyes, as the silken black of the same degree of Doctor of Letters, given him years before at Yale, could not do. His frank, defiant happiness in it, mixed with a due sense of burlesque, was something that those lacking his poet's soul could never imagine. They accounted it vain, weak, but that would not have mattered to him if he had known it. In his London sojourn he had formed the top hat habit, and for a while he lounged splendidly up and down Fifth Avenue in that society emblem. But he seemed to tire of it, and to return kindly to the soft hat of his southwestern tradition. He disliked clubs. I don't know whether he belonged to any in New York, but I never met him in one. As I have told, he himself had formed the Human Race Club, but as he never could get it together, it hardly counted. There was to have been a meeting of it the time of my only visit to Stormfield in April of last year, but of three who were to have come, I alone came. We got on very well without the absentees, after finding them in the wrong, as usual, and the visit was like those I used to have with him so many years before in Hartford. But there was not the old ferment of subjects. Many things had been discussed and put away for good, but we had our old fondness for nature and for each other, who were so differently parts of it. He showed his absolute content with his house, and that was the greater pleasure for me because it was my son who had designed it. The architect had been so fortunate as to be able to plan it where a natural avenue of savin, the close-knit, slender, cypress-like cedars of New England, led away from the rear of the villa to the little level of a pergola, meant some day to be wreathed and roofed with vines. But in the early spring days, all the landscape was in the beautiful nakedness of the northern winter. It opened in the surpassing loveliness of wooded and meadowed uplands, under skies that were the first day's blue and the last gray over a rainy and then a snowy floor. We walked up and down, between the villa terrace and the pergola, and talked with the melancholy amusement, the sad tolerance of age, for the sort of men and things that used to excite us or enrage us. Now, we were far past turbulence or anger. Once we took a walk together across the yellow pastures to a chasmal creek on his grounds, where the ice still knit the clay banks together like crystal mosses, and the stream far down clashed through and over the stones and the shards of ice. Clemens pointed out the scenery he had brought to give himself elbow room, and showed me the lot he was going to have me build on. The next day we came with the geologist he had asked up to Stormfield to analyze its rocks. Truly, he loved the place, though he had been so weary of change and so indifferent to it that he never saw it till he came to live in it. He left it all to the architect, whom he had known from a child, in the intimacy which bound our families together, though we bodily lived far enough apart. I loved his little ones, and he was sweet to mine, and was their delighted in and wondered at friend. Once and once again, and yet again and again, the black shadow that shall never be lifted where it falls,
fell in his house and in mine during the 40 years and more that we were friends, and endeared us the more to each other. End of chapter 23. Read by Dennis Sayers in Modesto, California, for LibriVox. Winter 2007. Chapter 24, the final chapter of My Mark Twain. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. My Mark Twain by William Dean Howells. Chapter 24. My visit at Stormfield came to an end with tender reluctant on his part and on mine. Every morning before I dressed, I heard him sounding my name through the house for the fun of it, and I know for the fondness. And if I looked out of my door, there he was in his long nightgown, swaying up and down the corridor, and wagging his great white head like a boy that leaves his bed and comes out in the hope of frolic with someone. The last morning, a soft sugar snow had fallen and was falling, and I drove through it down to the station in the carriage which had been given him by his wife's father when they were first married, and been kept all those intervening years in honorable retirement for this final use. Its springs had not grown yielding with time. It had rather the stiffness and severity of age. But for him it must have been swung low like the sweet chariot of the Negro spiritual, which I heard him sing with such fervor when those wonderful hymns of the slaves began to make their way northward. Go Down, Daniel was one in which I can hear his quavering tenor now. He was a lover of the things he liked, and full of a passion for them which satisfied itself in reading them matchlessly aloud. No one could read Uncle Remus like him. His voice echoed the voices of the Negro nurses who told his childhood the wonderful tales. I remember especially his rapture with Mr. Cable's Old Creole Days, and the thrilling force with which he gave the forbidding of the leper's brother when the city's survey ran the course of an avenue through the cottage where the leper lived in hiding. Strict must not pass. Out of a nature rich and fertile beyond any I have known, the material given him by the mystery that makes a man and then leaves him to make himself over, he wrought a character of high nobility upon a foundation of clear and solid truth. At the last day, he will not have to confess anything, for all his life was the free knowledge of anyone who would ask him of it. The searcher of hearts will not bring him to shame at that day, for he did not try to hide any of the things for which he was often so bitterly sorry. He knew where the responsibility lay, and he took a man's share of it bravely, but not the less fearlessly. He left the rest of the answer to the God who had imagined men. It is in vain that I try to give a notion of the intensity with which he pierced to the heart of life, and the breadth of vision with which he compassed the whole world, and tried for the reason of things, and then left trying. We had other meetings, insignificantly sad and brief. But the last time I saw him alive was made memorable to me by the kind, clear, judicial sense with which he explained and justified the labor unions as the sole present help of the weak against the strong. Next, I saw him dead, lying in his coffin amid those flowers with which we garland our despair in that pitiless hour. After the voice of his old friend Twitchell had been lifted in the prayer, which it wailed through in broken-hearted supplication, I looked a moment at the face I knew so well, and it was patient, with the patience I had so often seen in it. Something of puzzle, a great silent dignity, an assent to what must be from the depths of a nature whose tragical seriousness broke in the laughter which the unwise took for the whole of him. Emerson, Longfellow, Lowell, Holmes, I knew them all, and all the rest of our sages, poets, seers, critics, humorists. They were like one another and like other literary men. But Clemens was soul, incomparable, the Lincoln of our literature. End of chapter 24, the final chapter of My Mark Twain by William Dean Howells. Read by Dennis Sayers in Modesto, California for LibriVox, winter 2007.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
First, there was Tuesday. Then, there was Taco Tuesday. Now at Wendy's, there's Takis Tuesday. Get a new Takis Fuego meal, a.k.a. Takis Fuego chicken sandwich, Fuego fries inspired by Takis, a bag of Takis Fuego chips, a small drink, and also a small Frosty classic. Yes, you can get that any day, but on Takis Tuesday, the Frosty is free. Make every Tuesday a Takis Tuesday. Gotta be Wendy's.
Limited time only. Participating U.S. Wendy's includes 1 ounce Takis Fuego chips while supplies last. Takis and Fuego trademarks are used under license.